Dice Nation.
Grid Method. Greetings, everyone. This is Kevin Brown, and this is Device Nation, the voice of Operative Orthopedics. I hope you're having a wonderful day. I know I certainly am. You know, wonderful isn't that far away from Wonderwall. I saw a great article about this dubious Oasis song the other day entitled, "Wonderwall is a terrible song, and you're all terrible for liking it." Indeed. Four chords, whiny vocals, a freaking tambourine, so much not to like that when this very song came on in the OR yesterday, I told the room that if I was in a Turkish prison and you were looking to extract information from me, just play this song once. I'll tell you everything you want to know. I'll even lie just to make it stop. Look, I know opinions are the third rail in device sales, but I felt safe here as I was convinced this song is universally reviled. Boy, was I wrong when the nurse anesthetist gave me the stink eye and said, "I love this song." So where do you go there, fellow box openers? Well, "It looks good on you" came to mind, but I knew that wasn't a great fit. You know, I knew better. You offer an opinion in this business on anything at your own risk, but it wasn't a total loss as that whole exchange inspired me. Next time anyone shares their disdain for any song, I'm going to give them the stink eye. Try not to smile. That's going to be the hard part. And so, you know, that was the song we played at our wedding. And just sit back and enjoy the awkward. Well, nobody's ever going to give you the stink eye for sharing ideas, stories, and interviews to help take you from good to great. And a big part of that delivery here at Device Nation is bringing conversations from the OR suite. Well, today we're going to take off the PPE and venture into the C-suite with a very special conversation with the CEO of a company that was in front of the hip at a time when it was in the back of a lot of surgeons' minds. And the knee, well, let's just say they've really kept their eye on the ball. In Socket. You know the company, you know my history of bad puns, it's Medacta, and today we're going to meet its fearless leader, Francesco Sicardi. Really an inspiring conversation. You're absolutely going to want to hang around for that. Well, I was hanging out in Central, hanging labels on trays to be processed not long ago. I remember writing on the cards I taped to each tray, total hip, the date of the surgery, surgeon name, number of trays, and then this last request, label as end. Now, adding that tagline means 99.9% of the time, the tech will write on the wrap what's written on the side of the tray so everybody knows what's actually in there. You ever have to unwrap a tray just to find out what was in it? Sure you have. Well, one morning, I came in for cases only to discover all 10 trays I had tagged the day before this way had but one thing written on each and every one of them. The words "label as end" and nothing else. No one to blame here but me, as they did exactly as I asked. The other day, a hip tray lid found its way on one of my knee trays. "Label as end" got mistakenly turned into "label as top" that particular day. And what I thought were acetabular reamers were in reality a tibia tray. Does that sound familiar? All recoverable issues that provided a teachable moment for yours truly. Things I needed to change to ensure it never happened again. A nurse friend was sharing with me a similar situation that happened to her. A rectal scope lid got inadvertently put on a reciprocating saw tray. Of course, it got labeled as a rectal scope, put on the urology rack, and would not see the light of day again for 3 months. Now, I had to jump in and defend Central at this point, as technically, they did label as end. The dad jokes never end here, yet we intuitively know all good things must come to an end, like our series entitled...
Joy and pain are like sunshine and rain. Give it to Rob.
Joy and pain. I'm so going to miss Rob Payson, Eazy-E. Quick review. This whole series has been about trying to figure out why device sales has a retention problem. Forget quiet quitting, like really quitting. It's not everywhere, but it's enough to notice, as historically, this is a space a lot of people have wanted to get in, and very few left the party early. We came up with our patent-pending formula to explore this phenomenon. Retention equals joy over pain. High joy, low pain, that's a high retention number. 25-year veterans are not an anomaly. Low joy, high pain, on the other hand, that's a low number. That newly hired ASR just may be your most tenured rep already. We made a mnemonic out of the word pain, four letters representing four things that routinely came up talking with reps who have either left or seemingly have a foot out the door. P for the people in charge above you, that ever-present tension between sales and management. Management in some jurisdictions is truly inspirational. Others, well, not so much. A for atmosphere, what do people experience when they experience you, your distributorship, your company? If there's good air, so to speak, I've seen people get paid less and still hang around. If it's bad air, I've seen good reps walk away from great pay. Speaking of pay, eye for income. That has certainly changed in this industry, hasn't it? It's one thing to meet the overwhelming demands of this job and be compensated well for it. It's quite another if the pay is significantly lower than other options available. We identified three types of reps out there in the midst of all this. The undertaker rep, perennially negative. They complain about any and all things, especially change. Then there's the caretaker rep. They tend to have the strategic vision of Boxer the horse in Animal Farm, and their answer to everything is, well, just keep my head down. I'm just going to have to work harder. Then there's the overtaker rep, the strategic and visionary types always looking for creative ways to generate growth. That's exactly how we looked at these pain points thus far. No undertakers allowed, looking for positive and creative ways to address these very real issues. Today is no exception. I showed my cards at the front end of the show with an inventory buzzword grid method because that's the subject today. The letter N for inventory, or is it N for no inventory between back orders and the real squeeze on what you can have and how long you can have it before you start getting charged for it. That's no fun. It's something reps are talking about a lot. It was just the other week I watched a rep telling a surgeon what he would not have available for the case that was just getting ready to start. Oh my, that was no fun for the rep, I could tell. I was having a Mylanta moment just listening to it. Quick stupid rep trick right there, by the way. One of our past guests shared with us the difference between a problem and a surprise. Gaps in inventory being shared 10 minutes before the case starts, that's no longer a problem to work through. It's a surprise. Speaking of that, I read a Medscape article yesterday regarding physician burnout. Turns out orthopedic surgeons are among the top three least anxious of physicians, with only 29% regarding high anxiety levels in their job. 29% is still a high number. What would that number be if we weren't telling them about what implants they don't have for surgery 10 minutes before the case starts? But I digress. So what's the solution to these inventory woes, from gaps in cases to just managing a shrinking pile of stuff? Well, first things first, we have to make peace with a word that came to me from an obscure song way back in 2003 from a band called Big Dismal, entitled... Huge guitars on this song, by the way. Want a little production trivia? Bands pull this wall of guitar sound off by taking one track, plug that Les Paul into a Marshall, record it, and then copy it, paste it, copy it, paste it, layer it on top of each other until what you're hearing is 20 guitars all playing the same thing. Don't you wish inventory was that easy? That one 52-liner you have for your three cases tomorrow, well, we'll just copy and paste it. That's not reality, which is not accidentally the title of this song. What's the definition of reality? The world or the state of things as they actually exist. We have to live in reality on this inventory subject because the moment we start looking at today in light of how things used to be, like the five sets that just lived at the hospital for those two case Tuesdays, we're just going to get frustrated and start channeling our inner undertaker. So here's some inventory reality for you in 2023. Number one, and I want you all to repeat after me, I will never have as much inventory as I used to. Don't you feel better already? Number two, additional inventory does not get manufactured as a result of threats and mistreatment of your operations staff. Uh-oh, Kevin went there. Yes, I did. Look, I imagine over 29% of them are reporting high anxiety levels these days as well. Treat them right. Don't add to their stress. It does not create one extra box, but I digress. Number three, most of us work with publicly traded companies now, and inventory is but one metric they are responsible to their shareholders for. It's not personal. It's not subversive. Business is business. Now look, I mourn with you here. The last step of grief is acceptance. Embrace that new reality. Don't stress about what you have zero control over. Do we really need to go over the serenity prayer again? Put a smile on your face, fellow overtaker reps, and let's collectively figure it out. So what does that look like, Kevin? I have a nurse who does that Home Alone rendition of my name every time she sees me. It always cracks me up. So here's a few ideas for you. By the way, if you have an idea on this subject that's working well for you and your distributorship, please let us know at thedevicenation@gmail.com. We'll definitely get the word out. Well, number one, team structure. Wonderwall was released 28 years ago, and a lot has changed musically since then, thankfully. Has your team structure changed, or is it still the same four chords and a freaking tambourine? Well, I believe the next 5 to 10 years are going to be a fresh reimagining of what a device team should look like. Perhaps our next hire shouldn't be someone that covers cases, but a girl or a guy we'll lovingly refer to as a SKU. See what I did there? SKU is shorthand for stock keeping unit, a hybrid position, a field ops inventory manager that does not work at the home office, working working hand in hand with your team, handling the expired, the recalls, looking at the surgical calendar, knowing what needs to be moved where, knowing what needs to be on hand to do the case. They see a bipolar got put on for Friday afternoon. The case coverage rep just needs to get up and show up. Did I mention SKU puts trays together at the end of the day? Take all those responsibilities off the shoulders of the rep. And I promise you, the opportunity to sell stuff went up. The joy just went up. The pain went down. And we know what just happened to retention. How do I know that? I talked to a young rep who left recently, very well paid, mind you, but working 15 hours a day was severely impacting his WFE, work, family, enrichment. No surprise there. Had he had help on these things that were adding so many hours to the day, things SKU could have taken care of, I'm convinced he would still be around. Number two, templating. Now that SKU has carved out some time in your schedule, don't use it to watch more judge shows. Maybe it's time to approach your surgeon about templating your knee cases to help you manage your inventory better. Hips are invariably templated, but knees? Well, not so much. Perhaps that will save you from the Mylanta moment, telling your surgeon what they don't have when you know you really didn't need it to begin with. I love MedStrat, and getting your own account isn't that expensive. Think about it. If you need help on this subject, email us. We'll walk you through it. I'll even put together a video for you showing you how to template a knee in 60 seconds. Number three, communication. Again, there's a difference between a problem and a surprise. If your company is having supply issues, make sure your surgeon is aware of it long before you ever have to tell him or her about that 12 PS surface you don't have 10 minutes before the case. Don't be afraid to prime that pump, as letting them know ahead of time really smooths the road when you have to suggest perhaps an alternative just to make sure the case gets done. And look, this goes without saying, but I'll say it. Know your catalog, know your options. Just saying I won't have a 52 cup tomorrow is not the same conversation as I won't have a 52 cluster, but I will have a 52 multi and a solid just in case. Know your competitive options. Don't be insecure. Have a competitive product around to cover the gap. If the case templated a 56, you know you need a 56 dual mobility and yours is on back order with no release date. Call your friendly, hopefully friendly, Stryker, DePue, Zimmer, Medacta, whatever rep, take care of it and let your surgeon know they will have everything they need one way or the other. I've had to do this so many times over my career. I had to do it a few weeks ago. No shame in it. Your surgeon will appreciate it. Mine certainly did, as it took everyone's anxiety to below 29% on that particular day. Lastly, getting around the leaf vis-a-vis communication. Remember this great scene from Bug's Life? The ants are all walking in a line, gathering food to store for the winter, when out of nowhere, a leaf falls in the middle of the line, and here's what happens next.
I'm lost! Where's the line? It just went away. Then what do I do?
Help!
We'll be stuck here forever.
Do not panic! Do not panic! We are trained professionals. Now stay calm. We are going around the leaf.
Around the leaf? I don't think we can do that.
Where's the overtaker ant when you need them? Just because an inventory leaf is sitting in front of you doesn't mean you're stuck. It's not necessarily reality if all it takes is some healthy communication to elicit the change that gets you around it. How about starting that conversation, perhaps a series of conversations, with your local ops team, VP, distributor? No blame game. Be positive but persistent. Don't set and forget about your needs. Working within the chain of command. Look, I know it sounds crazy, but this topic rewards the squeaky wheel that's not actively pissing everybody off. A conversation with your surgeon can be really important here, by the way. Know their expectations. I covered an orthopod who experienced an intraoperative disaster at another hospital when an implant hit the floor. There wasn't a second set. There was no plan B. When he moved to my area, he was very adamant when he said, "Look, Kevin, I'll use your stuff, but you will have two sets of everything for me." I communicated that to my ops people, and guess what? Two sets of implants appeared for every one of his cases. Less bellyache, more communicate. And if that door continues to stay shut and you keep hitting a wall and wondering why no one's going out of their way to help you around that inventory leaf, at least consider that relational ATM machine. Have we been making positive deposits all along, or did we really believe mistreatment got us the inventory we needed and now our account is overdrawn? Well, if it's the latter, you might just keep hitting a wonder wall. I know. Look, it's never too late. Make selfless deposits into operations. Trust me, you need them now more than ever on this pain point, but don't do it because Device Nation said so. It's just the right thing to do, even if you never ever need an extra set of implants, or just one for that matter that's actually complete? Well, today's conversation is certainly extra as we talk to a forward-thinking CEO sharing his inspiring story of a company that's just come such a long ways in a short period of time. What got them from a skiing accident in the Alps to $500 million in sales? Let's find out. Francesco Sicardi, welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
What an honor and a privilege to have you on the show, sir. I so look forward to asking you about your current role as CEO at Medacta, Bikinis, Geisinger, KA, Sphere, even a little guitar. But first, let's go back to Switzerland. What was it like growing up in the Sicardi household?
We grew up in the Italian part of Switzerland, the southern part. Switzerland is very small, but it manages to make it quite complicated with German side, French side, Italian side. In my family was very, very much about business, medical devices, with the first company of my grandfather, and then grew by my father. Then was always business, traveling a lot, listening to those amazing stories and amazing deals all the time, myself and my brothers. So it was quite intense from the beginning.
High school, Leonardo da Vinci in Lugano, Switzerland. How distracting was it focusing on your studies in a town that's so incredibly beautiful? I mean, it just looks like a postcard there.
I think we've been very lucky. It is a very, very nice village, I would call it. It's 50 to 60,000 people living there on a lake in the southern part, so it's quite mild, the climate. Even in the winter, you're very close to the seaside in Italy, to the mountains in Switzerland in the winter. I would say when you grow up in such a beautiful area, you give it for granted. It was probably more distracting when we moved to university in a big city like Milan.
Biomedical engineering school at the Polytechnic University, and I smiled when I saw your thesis, cross-linking and thermal treatment of poly for orthopedic joint replacement. The die was cast for the family business at an early age, wasn't it?
Yeah, this was the early days of Medacta as well. So I started biomedical engineering in Milan, which was one of the very first universities, at least in Europe, that had full 5 years curriculum in biomedical engineering. In the last 2 years of my studies, Medacta was founded. I started to go and visit the little factory. There were no more than 20 people at that time. Cross-linking polyethylene was becoming a very hot topic. And so I decided to work with Medacta in developing this cross-linking polyethylene, which is still today a significant portion of our sales, almost more than 20 years later. So this was a very, very good way to start collaborating with Medacta. Unfortunately, at that time, I was not even paid. But that was a good experience.
Well, we can't bring up that family business, sir, without going back to your grandfather and your namesake. Tell us about this amazing man and his contribution to healthcare.
This was really the beginning of our family business, if you want, in medical devices. My grandfather was a pharmacist, and immediately after the war, he sold this little pharmacy in Torino, and he moved to Big Valley and started to develop this company called BF Medical, which was active in IV solution and dialysis, so sterile fluid. My father joined the company a few years later. It did become quite a global company with a lot of innovation in a space which is basically a commodity market. So they did manage to have a better product at a lower cost. And after 40 years of activity and expansion with plants back in the days, in the 80s, in China, in many, many countries, they managed to grow that business until Baxter knocked on the door. And at that time, they made an offer they were happy to accept. And this was the 40 years of experience of my grandfather and my father working together on the first company that my family built.
Am I remembering it right that he figured out how to deliver sterile solution in a bag?
Yeah, absolutely. At that time, the standard of care was basically either glass,
right,
or PVC plastic. The PVC plastic was quite dangerous in terms of cancer-related issues. So they basically redesigned and invented a new plastic film and a very special machine that was able to fill the bag, sterilize it in a very inexpensive way, so cost-efficient, and better quality. That was the key of their success at that time.
I imagine everybody listening to the show now will never look at a bag of saline the same way again, that your grandfather had something to do with that. That is so cool. Well, next in line, your father, I understand he was a physician. Tell us about him.
Yeah, my father is actually a pharmacist as well. He basically had a problem with his hips. Basically, 1 year before selling the company, he had his first hip replaced. And immediately after selling the Affemedital, he had his second hip replaced as well. And that's when he discovered the orthopedic market. Back in the days, was a market, as you remember, probably that was growing at 10-15% every year with incredible margins. But his experience as a patient was, let's say, suboptimal. And that's basically how he decided to start a small company in this new exciting field, which he didn't know at all. And I would say probably still today, you would be surprised at the level of technical knowledge that he has in orthopedics. He was a very, very bold move in a new space for him.
What did a hip replacement look like then? In Switzerland.
That's a very funny answer, because my father at 52, 53, when he was looking for a hip replacement, he visited a very big surgeons like Reinhold Gantz, other big names in Switzerland. And they basically told him that he was too young and he had to wait. So hip replacement in Switzerland back in the days for a 50-year-old patient was you have to wait. And unfortunately, my father didn't like that answer.
Sure. Or
maybe fortunately, otherwise we wouldn't be here. So he looked for alternatives. He was very much concerned about how long this hip replacement would last in a young, very active patient like he was. And he finally ended up being operated by Hohmann in Germany. The famous Hohmann of the Hohmann retractors, probably a name we all know and we all use. They were using quite a lot of ceramic on ceramic back in the days. Cross-linking poly was basically not available. And he had this hip replaced with ceramic on ceramic, and he thought, okay, this, it cannot be that a patient needs to look around for solutions in such a difficult way. And actually, the goal of Medacta at the beginning was to sell a guaranteed procedure to patients with materials and implants that could last up to a certain amount of time. And we wanted to give a guarantee behind that.
I was talking with a surgeon just the other day, just how impressive this all is when you stand back, founding a company and in just 24 years, operating in more than 50 countries, over 1,500 employees now. You've got footprints in joint replacements, spine surgery, sports medicine. Congratulations. That's just incredible.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's big achievement, but we like to say that is just the beginning. We do have a lot more to do. We still have a very strong momentum in terms of growth. We have a very small market share in many of our of the countries where we are present, including the U.S. We have even a smaller market share in the new business line like spine and sports med. So we think there's still a lot to do. We are very happy about what we have done in the past, of course, but we all look forward to what we can do in the future.
The very name Medacta, where did that come from?
I would like to tell you that we spend millions of dollars in a marketing study, but actually my father used to drive us in Leonardo da Vinci High School every morning. And in front of this high school, there was a little shop called Acta Med, which was selling medical books. He liked the name Actamed, and which means medical activities somehow in Latin, or medical writings, actually. And he flipped the name from Actamed, Medacta. So that's where it comes from.
What a great story. Many device companies that operate in the European theater don't set up shop here. Just curious, what inspired Medacta to enter the U.S. market?
I would say we were quite concerned about entering the U.S. market. We knew we had something special and interesting, and this was at that time the anterior minimal invasive surgery. And we had a lot of U.S. surgeons visiting Europe, attending congresses, and telling us that anterior approach was starting in the U.S. as well, with Joe Matta especially trying to push. And as you probably know, Joe Matta was a Letourneau fellow as well, a colleague of Dr. Frederick Lode, which was very important for us, but was basically to bring innovation to the U.S. market, which is, as you know, probably 50% of the global marketing value. So if you want to become a global player, you have to be present in the U.S. It is actually something I really pushed to do it. My father was quite against it at the beginning. I moved my family in the U.S. for a little over a year, early on in the starting days of Medacta USA, and I still keep very strong focus on the activity in the U.S., which is, as we said before, the most important segment of the market globally.
I talked with an employee of yours just this morning, and he was telling me that Medacta values are crucial to what y'all are doing, and it begged the question, what are Medacta values?
You know, Medacta values are very, very important to us because they represent a family company value. So we're talking about trust, about loyalty, about focus on the results, about teamwork. Those aspects are somehow part of most of the people that grew up within the company. But several years ago, when we started to have hundreds of new employees added every year, and now more than 200 every year in the last 3 years, we realized that it was important to make sure that those values were shared formally. And I have to say that today, 100% of Medacta employees worldwide, when we talk about KPIs and performance metrics, the B Medacta, that's how we call the Medacta values, are absolutely part, critical part of the performance review. And that's how we want to make sure that people not only know those values, but they live those values on a daily basis.
That's a great point. I remember a surgeon telling me one time, the strength is not in our differences, it's in what we agree on. That sounds exactly like what y'all were trying to accomplish through those values.
Yeah, I would say I don't mind differences at all. I think it can add a lot of value, but we have to have a very common and strong base on which we can build. I think the combination of both those aspects really create a lot of value.
Agreed. You brought up family, sir. I worked with a surgeon once who was a restaurateur, and he was adamant about having family on board. Medacta is a family-owned business. I was just curious, what are some of the advantages and disadvantages of that model?
The advantages is, of course, that there are some people that share exactly your culture and hopefully your goals as well. So we're talking about shareholders. I do work today with my younger brother. He's the head of the supply chain. And actually, he did a wonderful job in the last 3 years. It was quite a challenging period, of course. And my father, who was active as a CEO for 18 years. And my sister, she was mainly involved as a board member. In the early days, she was helping on the financial aspect. So the advantages is, of course, that you have 3-4 pillars around you on which you can really count. The disadvantages is that you basically never stop working. So when you have a Christmas dinner and you're all sitting together, after 5 minutes, you talk about work and the same happens on Sundays,
right,
and so on and so forth. So let's say it's a disadvantage or maybe another advantage, because under a business point of view, it's probably good. But it's, as I said before, it's quite intense. But we grew up in this way, so it's used to.
You know, we talked about the growth of Medacta since its founding in 1999, 15% the last couple years, which is just unheard of in the market we're in right now. If you had to pick one or two things to ascribe this growth to, what would it be?
I would say in general, excluding the last 2-3 years, which were particularly different, we really focused on innovation and the type of innovation that really brings value to the patient and to the healthcare system. Then if you have this kind of disruptive innovation, which can be anterior minimal invasive surgery or kinematic alignment or guarantees, and you sustain this innovation with strong focus on medical education, then you really have a good tool to sustain your growth. And we learned this mechanism when we started with anterior minimal invasive surgery, and then we utilize exactly the same methodology across all the business line, more recently with kinematic alignment, then on the shoulder with augmented reality and so on and so forth. So that is, in my opinion, the key. In the last 3 years, we probably were a little bit more aggressive than others. We continue to invest. We increased our salespeople while everybody was reducing costs. We never stopped in our medical education activities. We changed the way we deliver medical education. We invested in stock, in instruments to make sure that we could keep up with the demand afterwards. But there are different elements which were very, very peculiar to the last 3 years. But in general, I think it's more about innovation that delivers to the patients and to the healthcare system, sustained by medical education. That's our secret sauce, if you want.
Innovation, education. One phrase I see a lot on y'all's materials is healthcare sustainability. What's that all about?
You know, as a company, we started in Europe. The healthcare system in Europe really cannot afford easily innovation that simply call for premium prices without creating value. It's very difficult, for example, if you change a cup from standard titanium to 3D printed and get a premium. So you really have to develop a solution that can reduce hospital costs. If we think about minimal invasive solution, you can have, of course, if well done, improve patient outcomes. But you can reduce as well healthcare costs by minimizing hospital stay, by hopefully minimizing readmission, dislocation, and physiotherapy. And then depending on the reimbursement system, you can spin the message in the best possible way for this specific reimbursement system. If you start to think always in this way, when you think about innovation, you are able from time to time, at least, to deliver products that hit those two marks at the same time. And that's when you have the jackpots. So single-use instruments, minimal invasive procedures, personalized solutions. Those are key areas where we think healthcare sustainability and patient improved outcome can be hit with one single innovative product.
Well, one outcome I know a lot of people are always looking to improve is their financial outcome, always looking at good stocks to invest in. Medacta's listed on the Swiss exchange. Just curious why y'all only sold a third.
Yeah, this is a question we receive quite often from the investors in the financial world. And basically, we believe that Medacta is still probably the best investment that we could do as a family. So we wanted to keep a significant portion of our shares in Medacta. At the same time, as a family, we had this asset that in 20 years did grow from zero to basically over 2 billion market cap. And we wanted to rebalance our family office portfolio. You remember I told you we did sell a company at the end of the 90s. So we did set up a family office. We did invest in real estate, the financial market, and as well in the industry. So this is basically why we kept this kind of weird majority within Medacta. But at the same time, going public did really help us in setting up the best possible governance for the future of Medacta. They said that myself, my brother, my sister, my father, I have four children. This kind of setup forced a family to really respect the roles between shareholders and managers. We think that this is the best way to make sure that governance will protect the longevity of the company.
One investment that y'all made that is just absolutely beautiful is your U.S. headquarters there in Franklin, Tennessee. I drove through there recently. It's just a beautiful area, and I imagine it's probably easy to recruit talent to come move there, right?
Probably easier than other orthopedic capital of the U.S. It's a little bit like listening to the market when we try to improve products. We did listen to our salespeople and leadership. We did move to Tennessee, first of all, our logistics in Memphis. And as you probably know, the FedEx headquarters, the logistics headquarter of the U.S. is in Memphis. When we started to look for the headquarter moves, we realized that many of our managers were actually based in Nashville area already. We did receive a very good offer from the state to basically bring the headquarter in the same areas where the logistic center was, and it did make sense. This is a big capital of many hospital organizations, as you know, HCA and so on. It's a very beautiful area. Tax-wise for our employees is nice. The school system is great. The climate is great, and you are 2 hours flight from, I think, 80% of the U.S. population. So it's a very, very good area.
Well, let's talk about the products, procedures, and people that have you where you are today, sir, starting with a procedure near and dear to your heart. As we jump into the OR, Amos, love to hear about the journey developing this whole approach.
Yeah, you know, it is becoming almost part of our history. 2002, 2003, you remember the big push around the minimal invasive procedure in hips and knees with the double incision coming from the U.S. and the mini posterior, so on and so forth. And so we had this French surgeon visiting us, telling that they were actually doing the whole procedure with one of the two incisions that was pushed at that time by Zimmer. And the only thing we needed to develop was a little leg positioner. And actually, he did develop and was using a very basic solution since more than 10 years, because the hospital in Paris, back to the healthcare system, did not want to invest in a Lepronel table at that time. We look at it, we said, okay, maybe we will sell some hips in France. And we started to invest in this procedure. That's when some of the Swiss surgeons look at this technique and they immediately switched. And those were surgeons that were doing Müller type of stem cemented for the last 25 years, never changed anything. And then we said, oh, maybe that's actually a little bit better than what we thought. But we realized at the same time how critical was the learning curve of this procedure. We realized that patients were at risk because of this procedure. And as I told you, Medacta is probably the only company founded by a patient. And this was, for my father, totally unacceptable. So we basically set up a rule that was basically saying no train, no use. And that's how the Moore Institute started.
You brought up leg positioner. I was reading an anterior hip paper about the legendary Judet brothers, and this line jumped out at me. I'm going to read it just for a second. Those who have visited their clinic appreciate that forward dislocation of the head of the femur is greatly aided by their type of orthopedic table. That was written in 1953. Amos is greatly aided by a device of that very sort. Tell us about the table y'all've got and how it really helps this procedure along.
So we realized that this technique was quite challenging for surgeons that we're not used to. There was, of course, the possibility to do it without a table. We still have many customers doing it without a table, but it's definitely easier to learn it with a table, at least back in the days. We did develop this little leg positioner, we call it, more than an orthopedic table. Again, in order to make it really sustainable under an healthcare system point of view, we really wanted to bring a full package, so that the surgeon and the hospital did not have to combine different vendors, different investments. So this comes as a package with instruments, with a leg positioner, and most importantly, I would say, with a medical education support. This was probably the key of our success in the first 15 years of the company.
Carl Hueter described the anterior approach in 1881. We've been talking about this thing a long time, but booking cases has been another story altogether. It's taken quite a while to get some traction on the anterior approach here. What were some of the adoption challenges that you saw early on?
We mentioned the learning curve associated with this technique is, I would say, brutal. For the surgeon, it can be really frustrating. And we're talking very often about surgeons that are extremely efficient with their, say, historical approach, posterior, lateral, whatever is their approach. And now they're back in the learning mode for maybe 10, 15, 20, 30 cases, depending on their experience. I think the only reason why they continued is that even after a three-hour procedure, they could see a huge benefit for the patient. So we go back to the core aspect of innovation. Innovation needs to bring value to the patient. And if you really see value to the patients, you are probably motivated to push forward. If at the same time you can really deliver value as well under an healthcare system point of view, and you see that as a midterm goal at the end of the learning curve, then you have those pioneer surgeons that push through the learning curve and help us creating the medical education journey that we've been using over and over on a global scale and is still absolutely the key aspect and key differentiator of Medacta when we talk about anterior approach. Just to give you an idea, close to 90% of the hips we sell worldwide are implanted through anterior approach.
You talked about the educational component to all this. We've all heard see one, do one, teach one in this industry. And I've seen many surgeons prepare for anterior hips the traditional way, watch a video, 2-day course. You think that's sufficient for DA hips?
Unfortunately not. I would say even the most talented surgeons, they probably need a little bit more. Of course, you can go through that this way, but you expose your patients to potentially more complication risk, longer procedures, etc. So what we added with the Moore Institute was really a standardized process, if you want. So a surgeon interested would go and see a colleague one or twice. Then we would have one of those cadaveric courses. But it's really a course where you have one proctor at each table, maximum two surgeons per specimen, and you really go into the details of the procedure. We're not talking about implants, basically. And then the most important aspect is when the surgeon goes back to his hospital, there is always one of our proctor surgeons that has been in part of the Moore Institute that is helping the surgeon as many cases as he wants or as many cases as he needs. This is, in my opinion, the key. So we could really reduce the amount of stress which is associated with the first cases. And we always recommend to call again for support. We will never stop to give support until our customer is satisfied. And this is probably one of the key of, again, Medacta success is the tagline of the Moore Institute is the surgeon is never alone when discovering Medacta new technology.
That's a great tagline. And that stress component is real. I'm showing my age here, sir, but I've been in a lot of those first case for surgeons doing anterior, and it is stressful.
Absolutely. And it's not only stressful for them, it's stressful for the whole team. And this is another element that sometimes is neglected. None of the team is usually part of the anterior approach education. When you bring somebody in the theater, he can talk with the nurses, he can talk with an assistant, with the PA, with the anesthesiologist, so they can really help a lot. Positioning the patient, I mean, it's key. So there are a lot of small details associated that can be covered by an expert surgeon helping during the first case.
So let's stop right here for just a second for surgeons listening. So, you know, I'd like to learn more about the Moore Institute and maybe check out a course, see what you guys are doing. How could they connect with y'all?
We have on our website, medical education section. It's relatively easy to get online. Just contact us. And we really have an internal organization that is only taking care of that. The Moore Institute will contact back, making sure that we have the right dates and the right programs to cover your needs. It can be hips, it can be knees, it can be revision, it can be primary unis, technologies. So now that the programs are quite broad and there are a lot of options.
I was watching an interview just the other day with rising star Dr. Tyler Goldberg on Medacta TV. Great resource there, by the way. He said that Amos has made him a more elegant surgeon, and as he's become more familiar with the anatomy, that it's opened the door for no release and revisions through the anterior approach, and something that I've been looking forward to asking you about. What's a bikini incision?
The bikini is basically just moving the incision of the anterior approach in a more aesthetic way so that it is even more pleasant, if you want, to be under an aesthetical point of view for the patient. It's interesting for the Parisian lady, maybe some of the U.S. ladies as well. It does require a little bit of additional care, if you want, but it is the latest development, I would say, within the minimal invasive anterior approach camp.
Let's talk knees for a minute, sir. November of 2021 marked the 10-year anniversary of clinical experience and evidence of the Sphere knee. You've got more than 150,000 implanted now. Francesco, there are people listening who have no idea what a Sphere knee even is. Walk us through it, no pun intended.
Yeah, the Sphere was designed 10 years ago with basically the intent of providing AP stability in total knee. The mid-flexion instability is one of the remaining problems in total knee arthroplasty, either with a PS or with an ultracongruent or with a cruciate retaining as well. So with the bowling socket, which is the reason we call it Sphere, you have a full congruency from extension to full flexion in the medial side of the component, while you have basically a lateral flat design which allows for significant rollback. So the bowling socket design is basically replacing the ACL function providing full AP stability to the patient.
Let's look at some spherical history here, sir, a collaboration with Dr. Michael Freeman and Professor Vera Pinskarova. We've talked about Dr. Freeman's incredible contributions to our space on this show. That had to be quite an exciting project. Any highlights from that?
Yeah, it was, of course, quite an honor for me to meet Michael Freeman, Vera Pinskarova, and another name you didn't quote here, which I think deserves credit, is Kent Hamilton from Salt Lake City. They did a huge amount of work in understanding how the natural knee moves. And it is quite interesting that they did that at the end of their career and not at the beginning. So most of the design of implants that are coming from Michael Freeman were designed before really understanding the natural kinematic of knees. And that was quite an interesting journey for us to learn and capitalize from these findings and capture those rationale into the GMK Sphere design.
Francesco, the market seems to really be moving in that direction recently. Are the designs we're seeing in response faithful to Dr. Freeman's vision?
Yeah, I would say that the medially stabilized, medial pivot knees are now part of many companies' portfolio. I would say that there are still major differences between the true spherical knees and the J-curve with a medial congruent liner. Of course, it's quite easy to understand that the J-curve will lose congruency at around 30, 40 degrees of flexion, and that's when you have the mid-flexion instability. There are some other technical aspects that do really require a redesign of the femoral component and not only of a liner. But it shows that we were not completely wrong in betting on this knee design 10 years ago. I remember a product manager of Medacta USA told me that I should not expect more than 10% of our knees in the U.S. to be sphere. And today is 95%.
Wow.
So it was not too wrong.
I saw a poll recently where patients that had a CR/PS on one side and a sphere on the other were asked which one they liked better. 76% preferred the sphere. I'm just curious, what are you hearing from surgeons and patients about the why behind those answers?
I believe it's quite clear now, and there's more and more paper coming out. It's all about stability. So there are other papers showing that hinge knees, for example, are preferred by older patients because of stability. ACL, PCL preserving knees, when well balanced, are preferred by patients. So it's all about stability. AP stability is a critical aspect because it will not create retropatella pressure, anterior knee pain. And we basically can hope to have higher scores in terms of forgotten joint. And we cannot only hope that now, it's something that we have measured over and over in several studies, not only on our knee design, but on all the other couple of design, which are true ball and socket design.
That stability element of the sphere is such a real thing. A friend of mine has one and sent me a video of himself mowing the yard down a pretty steep slope downhill. And he told me it just feels incredibly stable and doesn't slide around. That's why he really liked it. Well, speaking of yards, we interviewed Dr. Stephen Howell here on Device Nation. He's been working in that kinematic alignment yard for some time, mowing the grass, and that grass is starting to look really good. There seems to be some real traction with this approach being paired with a sphere knee. Why do you think that sphere implant design is such a good pairing for kinematic alignment?
I think it's a relatively simple and logical answer. The sphere was designed by really studying the knee kinematic. We all know that natural knees are almost always coming with oblique joint line. Kinematic alignment is all about restoring the obliquity of this joint line in a pre-arthritic setting. So combining an implant that was based on natural kinematic with a technique that aim to restore the pre-arthritic natural kinematic clearly has a lot of advantages, let's say. It is quite clear that the lateral portion of the knee is much more loose in flexion than the medial side of the knee. And there is a huge variability between patients and patients. Some are having a lot of lateral rollback. Some don't have any lateral rollback. So you have to have a design in terms of implants that allows for those patient-specific features. And with the kinematic alignment, you really match those characteristics of alignment of each patient in an individual way. So those two things, they go hand in hand pretty well.
I did a presentation in 2008 to a higher up regarding some ideas that I was kicking around. Disposable instruments were on slide 15, and here it is, 2023, and that PowerPoint went absolutely nowhere for me personally. But I am so excited that 15 years later, somebody has figured out how to do a total knee, almost completely disposable, reamers and all. That's such a win for the surgery center model. Would love to hear about this incredible project there at Medacta and the vision behind it.
Yes, it is quite a challenging project because you have really to balance the cost with the quality. If you make quality, which is in terms of disposable instruments, which is too low, nobody will use it. If you make it too expensive with a quality great, nobody will be able to pay for it. So to find the balance between cost and quality of those instruments was a great challenge. And after 15 years, the fact that basically no one else is able to supply this kind of solution shows how difficult it is. It is a fantastic advantage in a surgery center model, but not only in the center in the U.S. For example, in Japan or in other markets where rotating kits are used a lot, you can imagine the big advantages of having a kit coming in, no need to clean sterilization at a cost that is reasonable and is actually making sense. And again, we go back to the principle we always mention. Innovation must be sustainable under an healthcare system point of view. And if you find a good balance, then it's a jackpot. Today, close to 50% of the knees we sell worldwide are implanted with single-use instruments.
Well, Francesco, one capital item that is decidedly not single-use only is a robot. I saw a great line the other day from an Australian surgeon who quipped that robotic joint surgery was not a penicillin moment in our space. I was just curious. Do you agree with that?
I would say that the robotic revolution that we have seen in the healthcare system with the Da Vinci was probably able to transform at least some surgeries from open to really MIS. You could do things otherwise you couldn't do. In the orthopedic space, we basically do exactly the same procedure, no less, no more minimal invasive. It is difficult then to really find improved clinical outcome, and definitely is not fully in line with healthcare system sustainability. As you can imagine, is really not in line with our key principle in terms of innovation. I think accuracy is important in some procedures. I think there are alternative technologies that can better balance quality with cost, and there are some which are coming to the market.
Great song from the 80s, "The Future's So Bright, I Gotta Wear Shades." Tell us all about NextStar.
Yeah, NextStar is our answer in terms of technology, is a fraction in terms of capital investment, is a fraction in terms of cost per case. It is an augmented reality platform, so you have all the three-dimensional planning, which is actually something we do since many, many years with the PSI as well. And then once you have your planning done, you have your glasses on, you see where you have to put your instruments, where you have to perform your cuts. In terms of accuracy, you use the same infrared cameras. The only difference is that we made it all single use, so that's even more practical in terms of ability to keep everything within the sterile field. And we believe this is a better way to deliver accuracy with a significant lower cost, both in terms of capital and in terms of cost per case. Again, I think in the ambulatory surgery center, this is definitely a better technology, but as well in other markets, in Europe, in Japan, in Australia, we see a lot of traction, not only in knees, but as well in total shoulder and in spine. In spine as well, we see a lot of interest, and NextStar is adding a lot of value by providing solution not only for total knees, but as well, as I said, in shoulder and spine. And more to come.
You know, we talked about the financial side of things between the hospital and the ASC. There doesn't seem to be a lot of extra money coming in to this whole system here in the U.S. these days. I was thinking about it in terms of two grocery store chains that I see over here all the time. Aldi with the tagline, spend a little, save a lot. And then you got Fresh Market, which is a premium shopping experience. That's been the hospital for so long. The market right now seems to be way more about Aldi than Fresh Market, and I don't think we've seen the end of that at all. How do we balance surgeons wanting access to guidance technology? And yeah, there is a cost associated with that, with so many hospitals struggling just to keep the lights on these days.
Yeah, and that's where innovation in terms of guidance technology comes in. As an industry, we need to come up with new solutions that are aligned with today's market, which is very different from 10, 15 years ago when robots started to be available. Today is a completely different market. ASCs are under pressures as well. Surgeons are much more keen in making sure that value creation is there. So the patient outcome versus cost must be fully justified, and innovation will continue to help address those problems. So I'm pretty sure that the technology we see today is not the same technology we will see in 5 years from now.
Well, before we leave the OR, Medacta has made a push into spine and sports medicine as well. Any products in particular you'd like to highlight?
Yeah, I mean, I just mentioned the fact that NextAR is a platform technology. So in the spine, even more than in the joint, you really need to have something different. Otherwise, you're just one of 200 plus companies selling screws and cages. And technologies like three-dimensional planning, PSI, augmented reality really helped in the last couple of years Medacta to differentiate further compared to many of the other smaller players in the spine. Sports medicine, we are just really starting there. We have seen an opportunity, especially entering into the shoulder market with a replacement. And I think this is somehow showing how much Medacta is investing for the long term, starting new businesses and new business line almost every 3-4 years. And we all know that it will take another 5 to 10 years before it really become an important element within Medacta. But that's exactly what we have done in the shoulder, in the spine, and now we will redo it in sports medicine.
Well, transitioning from the OR suite to the C-suite, sir, your father ran Medacta for nearly 2 decades before handing the reins over to you. Any mentors along the way that really helped you in this new role?
Of course, my father was a very, very important mentor. But as I mentioned to you, I wouldn't say that we started this company together, but I joined so early that Medacta was 25 to 30 employees. We really separate our roles early on. I took over the product development, R&D, the marketing aspect, while I was continue to learn from my father, the organizational aspect, the financial aspect, the boldness, if you want, in investing in areas where you're not 100% sure, which is always the case when you do something new. And I would say for sure my father was my most important mentor in terms of management.
I was reading yesterday about three types of CEO, the artist, the operator, and the entrepreneur. I'm curious, which one of those is your father and which one is you?
Oh, my father is clearly an entrepreneur, for sure. I mean, to jump into a completely new field, and when you are 53, 54 years old, of course, having the possibility of doing exactly nothing for the rest of your life shows that the kind of spirit that he had. Myself, I'm not sure. I would say I'm probably less of an entrepreneur. I had the luxury, if you want, of not having to start from scratch, which is extremely, extremely painful. And I have to say, probably I'm an artist and an operator. An artist, we always look for areas which are completely unknown, like, for example, the kinematic alignment, the sphere knee, the anterior approach, the single use. So we are really not concerned about new areas. But at the same time, I'm an engineer, so I really understand, or I hope so, at least. I really understand what you're talking about. I talk with surgeons. I talk with engineers. I know which are the challenges. I know the manufacturing side. I know the marketing side. So I'm definitely an operator as well.
I love your forward vision. And this Geisinger warranty I've been reading about is certainly a great example of that. Tell us about the knee with the guarantee.
Actually, it's not only on the knee side. We did expand the programs within Geisinger on the hip side, on the revision side, and more recently on the spine side as well. You remember I told you that the beginning of Medacta was really to start a company that could guarantee to patients some results. And when Professor Suk from Geisinger told us about his willingness to sell a procedure with a guarantee attached, we immediately said, okay, let's take a look and let's see how we can do it. The big advantage of Geisinger, as you know, is it's an integrated provider, so it's both an insurance and a hospital organization. And this really provides the best setting for the payer to understand the advantages of standardizing methodology and staying behind those results as a company and as a surgeon. This was quite an interesting, innovative idea that we managed to execute, and I'm pretty sure we will see more in this space in the years to come.
One thing that's certainly a guarantee lately, sir, is inventory challenges. We talked about that in my segment to fellow reps today. How does a leader of a publicly traded device company balance the financial pressures of inventory in the field with reps like me who want as many boxes as we can get our hands on to cover cases?
I would say that we try to align everybody's interest in terms of making sure that our assets are well utilized, especially, as you know, to grow in orthopedic can be financially extremely heavy. You have to deploy a lot of new instruments every time you have a new customer, new implants. So you really want to make sure that you serve your customer in the best possible way. At the same time, you don't want to waste your cash flow in investments which are not necessary. I believe we did manage pretty well in aligning throughout sales and marketing organization incentives, having a very good IT system that allows us to control it, and having a very strong and good logistic department that supports our salespeople and try to provide solution and not problems. So we tend to support sales as much as possible, probably more than others. But at the same time, we have a very good solution in place to make sure that everybody's happy.
Surgeon friend of mine shuttering his Bone Doctor barbecue sauce business. It seems like between the increased cost of shipping, cardboard boxes, packing peanuts, the margins were too tight to keep the enterprise going. And our space is kind of in the same boat, isn't it? With costs going up, but with ASP trending down, is top line growth really the only way out of this?
I wouldn't say so. I think there are a lot of costs that are built into the system that can be optimized. We work in different nations worldwide with different ASPs, and we know and we see what must be done in order to protect margins. The same way, I think it's important to make sure that the service and the quality remains our top priority, because we can talk about sales and margins, etc., but there's always a patient on the table, and that's our first priority.
Well, speaking of service and quality there, sir, I have to commend you for this. I called your headquarters the other day, and a lady with the loveliest voice answered the phone. Do you know how rare it is these days to call a major orthopedic company and talk to not only a person, but a person with a really cool accent?
I think you called the headquarters in Switzerland.
Yes.
And there's more than one receptionist there, and all of them are very, very nice people. We know how important it is. That's the first contact point for many people within Medacta, not only the people calling, but the people visiting us. And we really make sure that they understand how valuable they are to our company. And many of them have been with us for many, many, many years.
I'm so used to voicemail prompts. When she asked if she could help me, I didn't even have an answer for a while. Totally taken aback. You've seen a lot of successful reps along the way that have helped create this amazing growth at your company. I'm just curious, what do you believe separates the good ones from the great ones?
I believe it's really the reason why they're doing their job. If it is mainly financially driven, I think there's always a limitation. The great ones are the ones which are really pushing for making sure that the case is done, even if it is somebody else's product going in, that they really want to help a surgeon and making sure that the patient is going out of and you are in the best possible condition. When you do this, very, very often, in my experience at least, you even get more financially rewarded. So for me, it's important. The financial reward is a consequence of what you do and not the reason why you do it. And that's the big difference I see even in the great reps.
Agreed. For reps listening out there, thinking about a change, considering Medacta as a bag they'd like to carry, what would next steps look like for them to connect with y'all?
I think we receive quite a lot of contact requests from our website. I believe we start to have a relatively large organization in the U.S., so some of the reps out there might have personal contact. Don't hesitate. We have a lot of room for all of you listening. And actually, it's fair to say we grow because we have great products, but we only sell great products if we have great people. So it's all about people, and the number of new people that we hire every day and every year is crucial to continue on our organic growth path.
Francesco, as I prepared for this conversation with you, one thing that kept coming up was the Medacta for Life Foundation. Would love to have you take us out on a high note, telling us about this amazing initiative.
You know, the Medacta for Life Foundation is something that started for a very simple, basic reason. We wanted to set up daycare for our female employees in our headquarters. In order to do that in a proper way, we wanted to have a non-for-profit organization. And that's how the Medacta for Life Foundation started, with the goal of supporting what was at that time called My Baby. Just to give you an idea, today this activity grew so much. We have more than 250 kids from 0 to 10 years old. So we basically have a school within our headquarters at Medacta, which is open, of course, for our employees, but as well for our community. On top of that, through the Medacta for Life Foundation, we started to support humanitarian projects on a global scale. It's really a great activity that is led by my sister.
Well, managing a company, sir, of a global scale like you are, I know you don't have a lot of spare time, but I'm just curious, what do you do for fun?
I try to spend some time with my family, which, of course, unfortunately, I would say the time with them is often sacrificed to support Medacta's growth and needs. Whenever I can, I spend quality time. We go and have some nice travels. We play together some music. They all play different instruments, piano, violin, guitar, and we ski, of course. Being in Switzerland, that's something we try to do at least every second weekend.
Well, if you're out there skiing, we don't want a trauma spinoff for Medacta, kind of like what your dad did on the joints, right?
No, I don't think. I think we have enough on our plate with fine sportsman shoulder and joint alone that continues to grow before we will look for alternative. And the only thing that my people ask me is, please don't start trauma, because we like to sleep at night. So maybe not soon.
It's a young man's game. Guitar, you got my attention, sir. Acoustic, electric, what are you doing?
Yeah, I do both. I prefer electric. But again, it's something I restarted to do more recently with my kids, and definitely something that I should always try to do more. But unfortunately, we have 24 hours a day and I still need to sleep. So guitar is one of the few activities that is probably suffering the most.
Well, congratulations to you and the entire Medacta family on making Medacta what it is today.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Kevin. As I said before, I think the best is yet to come. And I really, really thank you for the opportunity of being with you today. Hoping that this will help Medacta become a little bit more known in the global orthopedic market. So thank you very much.
That was just an amazing conversation. All joy, no pain, hearing from such a unique leader in our space. Thank you, Francesco Sicardi, for taking time out to share your thoughts with a Device Nation audience, the best of the best. I was inspired by so many things he said about what makes a good rep, the concept of sustainability, which is applicable to rep coverage, by the way, his thoughts on technology, cost, value. But one thing that stood out in bold relief as we conclude our Joy and Pain series was the five Medacta values. What were they? Integrity, trust and accountability, results orientation, teamwork, and loyalty. Now, if we really want to move the needle on retention in our space, just walking these five things out individually and collectively takes care of a lot of pain points, doesn't it? The moment we veer and it's not about others anymore, not about the patient, but self-preservation, self-promotion, and all that, then we start affecting others, and every pain point we discuss throughout this entire series just gets bigger. But no finger pointing on this show. We can't change people. This all starts with you. It all starts with me. Let's sum it up here. We own our joy, and if we allow people or circumstances to take it away, well, you know what? That's on us. That's on me. I'm still working on this myself, as yesterday was a sheer act of will. Likewise, we own our responses to the things that create pain in our space these days. We are not victims. Every one of these points is addressable, by the way, from how we react to decisions we disagree with, from P for the people in charge to A, the atmosphere at the hospital. Have you noticed there's not a lot of joy there lately? To the atmosphere on the team, at the distributorship. This is changeable. Just know it starts with you. It starts with me. What about I for income? We encouraged you all to have a goal of 3 in 2023, adding 3 sidelines to your bag that don't compete with your existing book of business that just might allow you to hire SKU and change your life forever. And lastly, N for no inventory. We talked about it today, and it's like everything, right? There are things that we can do to affect positive change starting tomorrow. Speaking of positive change, again, a huge thank you to Francesco Sicardi being an agent of just that in our space. Still the best job ever. Retention number is still high for me. I hope it is for you. Check out what they're doing at medacta.com. The surgeon is never alone indeed. And no, the rep is never alone either. Kevin, will you just leave me alone? No, we're here to serve you and wish you great success and a wonderful day.